Welcome to CREPN Radio for influential commercial real estate professionals who work with investors, buyers, and sellers of commercial real estate coast to coast. Whether you're an investor, broker, lender, property manager, attorney, or accountant, we're here to learn from the experts.
Welcome to Commercial Real Estate Pro Network's CREPN Radio. We're so glad you could join us. My name is Jadarren Gross. I am a real estate investor and a commercial property insurance broker. I've been an insurance broker for 25 plus years, and my primary client is and has been real estate professionals, investors, landlords, property managers, and developers. Based on this, I'm continually looking for more expert input and information about real estate for both my own investments and so that I can be a better resource for my clients. The result of my search has led to this, the creation of Commercial Real Estate Pro Network and CREPN Radio. No matter how you found us, whether it be LinkedIn, Facebook, iTunes, Blog Talk Radio, Twitter, or YouTube, we would love to hear from you. Your comments, likes, shares, and follows are greatly appreciated. Today's topic, we're going to get into the topic, the 2016 has been dubbed the year of the drone, and we're going to talk a little bit about how drones are being used in commercial real estate. Technology is moving at a fascinating rate and with new opportunities and uses every day. One such development is the drone. Once it was only a military aircraft, is now a gift under the Christmas tree. Drones are now available to the public and are being used in business to provide stunning images and video for all sorts of things, including commercial real estate. To better understand the use of drones in commercial real estate, I sought out expert Paul Tice with Topa 3D. Here now is my interview. All right, with me today, I've got Paul Tice. Paul Tice is with Topa 3D. Paul, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me, Darren. Appreciate it.
I appreciate you taking the time to get with us today. Paul, before we get going too fast, I wanted to ask you a little bit about how long has Topa been in business, or Topa 3D? And so if you could share a little bit about how long you guys have been in business.
Yeah, sure. We went into business in October 2013. I'd worked at a previous firm doing 3D scanning and mapping and 3D modeling for architects and engineers, and I found a way to market this specifically to some new demographics, and I just found a space for myself to do this on my own. So I left that company and I started Topa, and I started developing clients almost right away, and we went from there. And since then, we've been doing a lot of really fun things, really interesting things, and useful things for our clients.
Great. Now, you mentioned you were doing the 3D before. I guess when, and I'm just thinking kind of historical from the drones, I think the first time I heard about a drone was possibly one during one of the Gulf Wars, and it was more of a surveillance kind of thing. With drones, I guess I typically think of more photographic type applications. Is that not what you guys are doing, or are you going more? Tell me a little bit more about what 3D modeling.
Yeah, so what's really fascinating about the drone technology is the stability of these unmanned aerial vehicles. Back in those days, during the wars that we've had, unfortunately, drones actually have been an asset in the sense of monitoring, or what they call remote sensing. So they've been used as a tool to fly at high altitudes with really powerful cameras to be able to see on the ground what's going on. And in thermal, using multi-hyperspectral imaging and all kinds of interesting sort of ways of looking at the ground on different spectrums. And that was a really powerful tool for the military. But, you know, that stability, some of that technology has been put into these remote control quadricopters. So these little, almost like toys, is how people think of them a lot of times. But what's so amazing about them is they have sometimes 13 or more sensors on them just to keep themselves stable in high winds or whatever. They have GPS, accelerometers, barometers, sonar. They have all these little things built into them. And with that, you can leverage a lot of really cool things. One of the main things you can get is a stable camera platform. So the new cameras coming out for these new drones that are usually $5,000 or less have a very, very high resolution, can fire video in 4K. They can do some really amazing cinematography, but and we've done that with those. But what they also can do is what we call photogrammetry. So photogrammetry is really the science of stitching images together. And anybody who takes a panorama with their iPhone is essentially using an app or an algorithm that's based in photogrammetry science. We just don't know it. We don't call it that. But this idea is if we can take the drone up and we can fly and do overlapping photos, take overlapping photos with this drone, then we can stitch those photos together. But it doesn't stop there. We can also take those photos and using this sort of pixel-to-pixel matching, it can actually extract a 3D model from the photographs. And that's being used in a lot of app applications as well, like 123D Catch and some free apps you can get online. But what we use is some more powerful software. It can extract very accurate 3D models of large landscapes that are measurable within sometimes millimeters. And that's really useful for engineers and architects who are trying to plan new buildings or new sites, or environmentalists who really want to know where river streams are going in an accurate way. I think the second thing I want to mention about these drones is their capacity to lift objects is growing. So they have the ability to lift some of them up to 50 pounds. And that means we can put even heavier camera systems or even what they call LiDAR systems on them, which are essentially laser scanners. So LiDAR is this concept of light detection and ranging, and these drones can carry these laser sensors up into the sky and fire lasers to the ground, and those lasers hit the ground and then bounce back, and what that creates is a 3D sort of modeled image of the surface that's extremely accurate. And we can talk about that for days about how that science works, but it's just a really amazing platform to get data from areas that you normally couldn't get any other way, or areas that you would have to use a hired pilot and a plane and fuel and all those expensive costs. And this particular medium is extremely inexpensive. You know, it doesn't use any fuel. It just uses lithium ion batteries, and you can accomplish exactly the same thing, sometimes even better.
And so you touched on a little bit, prior to drones being employed to do this, what were the means that people would be able to collect this data or be able to, or were they not able to collect the information?
In a lot of cases, they just weren't able to. You know, usually you'd have to contract a helicopter or a fixed-wing pilot to collect aerial photographs, for example, or a balloon, or even on some cases, a satellite. Like Google Earth uses a lot of their imagery just from satellites, and it's really good. I mean, the resolution is pretty amazing for something like that. Their cameras are, you know, millions and millions of dollars. But the advantage of the drone is its accessibility to everyone. And these little guys, they can fly for 15 to 45 minutes, depending on the battery type and the drone type, definitely for less than $10,000, in most cases less than $5,000, you can fly an aerial mapping mission, and all you're paying really is the wages of a guy who's controlling this thing on the ground, looking at a monitor and watching in real time what the drone is seeing, so that his mapping mission is going seamlessly. But we can also program them to fly autonomously. So there's apps now for these drones that you can just sort of draw a square on a Google map on your app, and it will fly grids. It'll figure it all out and fly grids and map that whole region without you touching anything. So there's, you know, there's complete safety. Nobody's in the plane. There's no risk there. And you're getting data in real time. And in our case, we can turn around that data within 24 hours because we use some cloud processing tools. And in the past, photogrammetry used to take a technician who was licensed, had a lot of skill in this sort of software, and it could take weeks to put that together, and now it's just happening instantaneously. As a sort of caveat to that, it is a state law, in Oregon at least, that you have to have a licensed surveyor or photogrammetrist to produce aerial maps that are going to be used for engineering or architecture or state government applications, because they have to verify the accuracy. But again, it doesn't take that skill set to acquire the data. So it's just becoming so easy now and so safe that it's opening up to all kinds of new markets and demographics.
Well, I got a couple of thoughts here. If before there was this need for, and it sounds like you still have the confirmation need for the, I didn't quite catch the title of the person for the confirmation of the information, but it sounded like before they had to be on board the plane for the collection of the data. Did I miss that?
Well, you know, in some cases, usually what it would take is a camera operator in the plane and then the pilot. And so they would, you know, chart out their mission. They would chart out how they were going to fly grids. And then the pilot had to be sure to fly at a certain altitude and a certain airspeed. And then the camera was calibrated to all of that so that when it would fire a shot, it actually was like a shotgun recoil, and it would take the picture as it recoiled back to compensate for airspeed so the picture wouldn't be blurred. So there was all this sort of mechanical science that went into taking an aerial photograph. But nowadays, you know, the shutter speeds are so fast, and you just don't need things like that. And we can fly the drone at any speed we want from the ground, and when it's flying autonomously, it all programs that information into it so that the camera compensates autonomously as well. So the process has become so simple that it just has eliminated the need for this high level of training and cost to produce those images. And then when we get to the ground, when we have that data, those images, and we have to, you know, maybe process that through a computer on the ground, that's when you are required to have a licensed photogrammetrist, is the name of it, or a licensed land surveyor, which is, you know, a five-year program plus a sort of internship that they have to go through to be licensed in that way to produce legal, measurable, and accurate maps. But as I said before, kind of anybody can do it. And if people are just going for non-commercial maps or, you know, personal use maps or maps for 3D models and things like that, it's a little bit different thing. And that kind of licensure is sort of gray right now on what would be required for that. It really just depends on the application.
Gotcha. So on the let's talk a little bit about the storage of the photos. I think the one thing that any parent has come to realize that in the old days you maybe took a roll of 36 frames and you went down to your photo processor and waited an hour or a couple of days and got back some prints, and there might have been one photo in there you wanted duplicates of to send to the grandparents or whatever. Whereas now we've all got phones and cameras and miles and miles and miles of footage. And the storage of it, you know, it's either you share it, delete it, or you know, find that little spot, and maybe you get a little more creative and make a video. If you're creating these, and I'm assuming it'd be the equivalent of miles and miles and miles of video footage,
sure.
How do you guys go about storing that? And then is there any interpretation? I'm wondering, you know, again, if you take those miles and miles and miles of things and it's not hidden, but in a couple of spots that are really of interest, can you describe a little bit about that? Because that seems like if it's not a concern, it's going to be a concern, how to store and manage all that data.
Well, you know, first of all, we have computers with terabytes of hard disk space. So the latest computer.
Yeah, what's bigger than a terabyte now? Have we gotten to the word there?
You know, I think it's like a petabyte. I don't know, but I'll learn as we all go.
Yeah,
right?
We're all going to get there soon.
Right. So, you know, my personal computer is a 9 or 10 terabyte hard drive, and it's just, there's just so much data. So, you know, when we fly drone missions, for example, to map an area, we just throw a 32 gigabyte micro SD card in the camera, and mm-hmm. off it goes. That's plenty of space to contain all the data. And then, you know, as far as processing that goes, we just, it numbers them sequentially, right? So we just throw that into the computer, and the algorithms figure out how to sort it all out and organize it. So we don't really have to think about it. It does its own pixel by pixel color matching to stitch those images together. And if an image isn't fitting, it'll flag it. So then we might have to go in and sort of tweak the data in a couple of areas. But for the most part, it's mostly automated. So that takes a lot of the nightmare out of what used to be a very manual process.
Right. So then if you, and again, my thought process on this, you know, was more of if I hired you to come out and you know, fly my property or my building or whatever, that I'd be looking for evidence of or confirmation of things are good or evidence that there's a problem that needs to be attended to. Is it then, does your customer then take that and observe as they choose, or do you guys provide any assessment of the information?
Well, for the most part, we provide the data. And we have been asked to analyze things, and we can do that. But most analysis is really based around the accuracy of the data. So when we provide a 3D model, for example, of a property, maybe there's a boundary dispute or something other, some other case going on, or they need to know the volumetric calculations of how much dirt they have in their backyard or something like this. We can just go through and just verify that those numbers are accurate. And we always go through this process with a client, which we call a discovery meeting. And in that discovery meeting, we really hash out the scope. What are you going to use the data for? How do you need it analyzed? How can we support you with that? And then we always give them this warranty on the data for the life cycle of the project. We'll offer them unlimited support, which often involves us going directly to their house or their place of business and having those direct conversations or hands-on training with this new kind of data on their computers themselves. And we give a ton of presentations every year just to educate people on how to use this data better.
And so, well, I know just from my own little family videos, there's a lot of El Boro for the 2 seconds of "Wow, did you see that?" kind of thing. But in the business you're in, I would think it's a confirmation that things are good or to recognize a problem that needs attention. In fact, if we could maybe kind of transition into, can you describe a typical customer client that might hire you and what a job might look like?
Well, sure. We have, most of our services have to do with remote sensing or what we call 3D surveying on steroids. And what that's all about is sort of observing things or measuring things from a distance without having to create any impact on the site itself. So a client could be a historic preservation architect or somebody who specializes in architectural conservation. And they come to us and they say, "Hey, we have this massive historical building. It's been here forever, and we want to remodel it, or we want to put it into an adaptive reuse model where it's going to be sort of gentrified and turned into cafes or, luxury condos or something like that. But we want to keep the shell, or we want to keep the site sort of pristine as it used to be." So especially in the Portland area, there's just so much of that going on. It's really delightful how we have, gentrified some of the Pearl District and done all these things here. And it always starts with a survey. So what they'll have us do is they'll have us come out and give them what they call the as-built sort of verification of that space. So whether it's from the air or from the internal spaces of the building with a terrestrial laser scanner that fits on a tripod, we will, in 3D, measure that entire space and produce a 3D model that's extremely accurate, usually within about a quarter inch accuracy for that entire building. Or landscape. And so from that, they can take that data into their, design software, which is usually kind of like computer-aided drafting software like AutoCAD or PlayStation. And with that, they can take all the measurements they need to plan how they're going to redesign that building. So that's a real typical type of client for us. They need measurements, they need them accurate, they need them fast, and they need them very comprehensive. They need to know where all the soffits are and everything else on that building, and that's absolutely what our instruments can provide them.
I was going to say a quarter inch accuracy and the speed you're doing it at, that's pretty impressive. I've mapped a few buildings myself and always had to do some rounding to make the building square. But
right.
It sounds
right.
Like it's a trap.
The nearest foot. And that's the truth of it. In the old ways, we just did a historic grandstand out in the deserts of Arizona and Phoenix, on the Arizona State Fairgrounds. We just did that a couple of months ago. And this grandstand, it's massive. It would have taken probably 15 student interns with scaffolding and ladders, maybe a month or two, to measure that whole thing out with all the beams and bleachers and everything else that's going on there. And we did it in 4 days and had all the accuracy that we needed. So it's just a remarkable technology that's completely disrupted the way that we measure the world.
Yeah. No, you say disruptive. I think that's one of the things I love about all this new technology is there's the opportunity in it, which a lot of times the people that were traditionally the operator or the gatherer, in this case, of the information, may be resistant to because, no, we always do it this way or trying to protect their job, their way of generating a paycheck.
Sure.
But, the technology is moving so fast and it's providing so much more of a rich representation of the information. It's just fascinating to me just how fast it moves and just how much better it is than anything previous.
Well, for sure. It saves money. And I guess I want to just quickly add that it doesn't really take away jobs. It just changes the jobs. And actually, it adds new jobs. The only thing that we ask in this industry of people is that they get to learn something different. That's really what it boils down to.
Right. No, and I think the reference there was not that it takes jobs as much as I think that it changes a job.
Sure.
And I think that for those that are interested and excited and are looking for new opportunities, it's an opportunity to expand your ability and your skills and stuff. I find there are those that tend to be resistant to the new and can't see the value in it. And I'll raise my hand. I've been there a few times. Not exactly excited about changing or new, but once I engage the technology or whatever the new thing is and understand the benefits, I'm like, holy crap, what was I, why was I waiting? why was I being that, what was it, the slow skis or whatever? I think some sort of campaign.
I think that's
there.
True. Yeah, I think that's true for all of us. I've experienced that too. Our industry, well, as I've been in the business, it's changed. And I'm like, oh man, we gotta learn this new software now. And the training just, it takes, a couple of months sometimes. But at the end of the day, it's usually a better fit. So yeah, I can relate.
Sure. So on the speaking of the kind of the trend on technology, I know, it wasn't too long ago that 1080 HD was the benchmark or the high end, and now they've got the 4K cameras and TVs are now being sold in 4K. I'm still kind of curious how they deliver all of the bytes. I guess if you have a disk or some sort of downloaded file, you can watch it in 4K easy enough, but just to get the bandwidth of, the data on a live stream might be a little difficult, but I'm curious, are you guys doing any kind of, or what's the level of capture you're using right now for your video?
Yeah. So actually, as you'll see in a video that I'm going to show you, for a little organization here called Clive Coffee. They make high-end coffee makers, really, really beautiful stuff. So we did a shoot for them, sort of a cinematography shoot with our DJI Inspire drone, is the brand it's called. And that shot in 4K. So that's what we like to shoot in. And then from that, in the post-processing, you know, you can degrade it if you need to, but you can't ever go up if you shoot low. So we always start high and move down. So we shot some really nice aerials for them to integrate with that commercial. And so as you start looking closely at commercials that are coming on TV, even for car dealerships and stuff, they're getting these interesting aerial shots. And with a trained eye, you can tell what resolution they're shooting it in. But yeah, we try to go 4K on everything, and it's some beautiful stuff. We have some new projects coming up. That it's going to be some supporting some nonprofits, and that's what we're going to be shooting in as well. It brings a certain kind of drama to the process.
I caught a video here. I guess it was this weekend. There was that big snowstorm in New York, and there was a guy. If you've heard of him, Casey Neistat. He was snowboarding through the streets of Manhattan and had some drone work there capturing it was pretty cool. Let me ask you, so what's, you mentioned kind of a couple of different types of projects. What's the craziest thing you've done with a drone?
Oh, well, that's a great question. One of the things that we've been sort of playing around with is this idea of hanging these. It has about 6 GoPros that fit in this 3D printed enclosure. And so from the belly of the drone hangs 5 GoPros. They're 4 pointing in all different cardinal directions and then 1 pointing down. And then we put another GoPro on the top of the drone. We mount that up there. And so what we do is we fly video. So what it's creating is basically a live feed video virtual tour. So what it does is it stitches all of those videos together into one sort of 3D experience that you can view with virtual reality goggles like Oculus Rift. So that's probably the craziest innovation that we've had the privilege and opportunity to start playing with.
That 3D thing is kind of a neat deal. I know even like I'm in insurance, and we use a fair amount of the Google Earth, or not Google Earth, but just the Google, the streets. I think it's a street view kind of thing where they've got that ability just to kind of, you know, you can stop in front of a building and you can turn to the left, turn to the right, turn up, down, turn, you know. And, sure. It's amazing how much time that saves compared to the old days of having to drive out with your Polaroid camera to take a picture that was probably hard to tell what you were looking at in the first place, if the lighting was wrong or you were not too steady with the camera there, but it's all good. I kind of ran past, I had kind of more of a sequence of questions, and we got talking, and I wanted to kind of stay on the track we were running on there, but how did you get started in flying drones?
Well, actually, I only started flying them about a year ago. I had some people in my life and business colleagues who were doing it, who had been doing it for 20-plus years. You know, it was RC was their hobby. And when these quadricopters came out, as I had suggested earlier, and the stability that they have, it kind of changed the landscape in that world on what we can do with them. And so last year I bought my first DJI product. I like those. There's other ones out there, 3D robotics. There's a lot of manufacturers of these guys that do basically the same thing. Anyway, I bought this drone, and it cost about $3,500 altogether, and which felt like a pretty large purchase for something that was relatively small and so forth. But when I found out how powerful and stable the camera was, and what I could do with that, especially with the extraction of 3D models with the software that we've got, I was sold. I decided this is an amazing technology, and they're just really fun to fly. They're really stable. They're really easy. You don't even have to touch the controls for it to hover in one place. I just had a lot of fun with it. So right now I'm finishing up my commercial pilot's license is coming. But right now I'm finishing up my private pilot's license so that I can be one of the extra pilots in our team to fly these drones commercially, which is a requirement by the FAA right now to have a commercial, or a licensed pilot to fly the drones commercially. So we have one on staff right now. He used to be with Lockheed Martin and NASA, actually, as a satellite engineer. So he's been teaching me a lot about the science of remote sensing and different types of camera sensors that we could put on these things.
When you say license, is this equivalent to flying an aircraft? Could you get in?
Yeah, so I have to actually get into a plane with an instructor and take flying lessons. I passed my ground school exam. I have to actually be a licensed pilot, a real pilot, before I can personally fly the drones commercially. So far, I've just been training on the drones, and I've logged dozens and dozens of hours on the drones that we have as sort of a recreational training exercise. But when we do projects, we have to have a licensed pilot on site to do those, to get paid commercially. Yeah.
Huh. And the thinking behind that, is that more of a all aware of the surroundings kind of thing and creating harm to others? Or?
Yeah, it's absolutely... in the FAA's mind, and I agree with it, it's a sense of responsibility. It's a knowledge of airspace. We always have to give right away to manned airplanes if we see them in the sky. Our drones have a GPS governor on them that will not allow them to fly above 400 feet, although you can certainly remove those. That is the certificate of authorization that we have. We have to fly under 400 feet, so we're staying in this G sort of general airspace area where regular manned aircraft will not typically fly. We're also not allowed to fly within 5 miles of an airport. And there's several dozen rules that we have to adhere to fly these guys. So if we are in a situation or a project that requires a drone flight that's close to an airport, we have to call the tower. We have to get permission. If they don't get permission, then we have to find another way to do the project. So it can be very restrictive, but there's a reason for that. You know, there's been a few deaths that have been logged from, you know, people being really irresponsible with these unmanned aerial vehicles. Even though they're small and they seem like a toy, because you can control them so well and specifically, they could get people in a lot of trouble, and they're absolutely disastrous for a manned aircraft if it hits one. So we agree with the idea of having responsibility with this process.
Yeah, it makes sense. I've seen the Amazon commercials about packages delivered in just mere minutes and all that. And I think if you let your mind kind of go you know, it really does explode into these additional opportunities, the need to be able to control the chaos in the air would be that much more critical, especially with, there's aircraft with people in them. You don't want to be taking them out. So let's see, you touched a little bit on the drones. Have you crashed any drones?
I have.
Yeah. Do they
several
survive?
Times, actually. No, one time it didn't. luckily we were under warranty, and so they fixed it. One of the most catastrophic crash was it was a really hot day in Arizona. That was one of the places that we were testing it out, and we were actually doing some photogrammetry work with the drone. Out in the sticks there in the desert. And, you know, the temperatures that day were about 112 to 115 degrees. It was ridiculous. And the drone, when they say the operating temperature maximum of the drone is such, it's probably a good idea to go ahead and follow that because what ended up happening is we believe the battery just overheated and it simply dropped out of the sky. Just the rotor stopped and it just hit the ground and sort of broke into pieces.
Wow.
Yeah, so, you know,
No parachute on board, huh? Just drop like a rock.
Drop like a rock, just quit. And that's, it is a mechanical device, and it's a lithium-ion battery, and those things do have their limits and so forth. I've never had that happen before or after, but But there's a reason why the FAA also regulates that you're not supposed to fly over people's heads or cars or things like that, because, you know, there is always a chance that something can go wrong.
Well, it doesn't sound like you were it was not a piloting error then. I wouldn't say a crash that you crashed, but it sounds like you learned the limitations of temperature and the device there. So.
Sure.
Let me ask you, so we've touched a little bit on the rules for flying drones. Are there any insurance issues you guys run into? I mean, as an insurance broker, I'm kind of curious on that. What are there any issues you run into there?
Sure. So, one of our colleagues, for example, I can give you a couple extreme cases, but for the most part, yes, we're required to carry insurance, liability insurance, and so forth, errors and omissions insurance for our data. But some particular projects require special insurance, and drone insurance in a general way can start at $2,500 a year, but it can go up to $8,000 a day. It really depends on what type of project you're working on. If you're on a movie set doing cinematography, it can be very expensive to fly per day because they have a closed set and they have all these rules and so forth. One of our colleagues flew a hydroelectric dam up in Washington and mapped that with permission from Bonneville Power, and they got the insurance. They paid the insurance for that, but that, as I said before, was $8,000 a day. Just to fly that mission. So it can range, dramatically. Depends on what you're doing.
Well, I've seen some information about it, but hadn't, run into the opportunity to dig any deeper. Didn't have the need to. So, but that's interesting. As far as applications, in the different industries, it sounds like you guys do a lot. I mean, are you guys wide open? If somebody needs a drone, you guys kind of go out and scout the project and then make it happen? Or, I mean, from mapping a dam to a movie site to a building, I was thinking originally when I contacted you more about just, flying a commercial building to, understand the condition of the building. But can you give me any kind of a range of?
Sure. Well, yeah. So we like I had said before, we've done cinematography and we've done mapping. We've done a lot of different things with this instrument, and so when a client asks for a certain thing, what we usually do is we decide what's the best tool for the job. So we don't always need the drone. We can use the terrestrial scanner that's on a tripod. We can use a hand scanner that, scans small objects or parts that has micron-level accuracy, or we can use these flying devices to capture that data. And we can use a combination of the two as well. We can combine data from multiple different platforms into one contiguous 3D model to get it from all angles and all areas. So it just depends on what they ask for, but we're open to taking anything because once you learn to pilot these things well, you can kind of do pretty much anything you want, including nice sweeps and loops and so forth for movies or just very steady grid flying for mapping.
Got it. So you've referenced Arizona a few times as far as places you've operated. I know when we talked earlier, you've got people down in Roseburg. Is there a territory or a limitation as to the places you'll go to operate a drone? Or
no, we have a collaborative that we work in. We call it Invictus Solutions. Invictus Solutions is kind of our drone hub. They're based in Roseburg, and they work with a handful of collaborative firms. So Topa 3D falls into the data processing aspect of that collaboration. So a lot of the other companies have specific types of drone setups, and then they shove that data up to us to process a lot of times. Topa also flies our own stuff as well, but to get the most, you know, the largest set of tools, we collaborate with other firms in the area. So we have, in our collaborative space, we have a professional drone company that's over in Afghanistan doing stuff for the military. We have people doing stuff all over the United States, but there's only about half a dozen of us in this collaboration. So as far as TOPA specifically, we've done things all over the United States, clear from to Philadelphia all the way back to Oregon. So really no limits on what that looks like.
That's cool. The opportunity to go worldwide and doing the drone thing. That's neat.
Yeah.
Do you have any sense of the future where things are going, or?
Yeah. So, you know, we have drones now in our arsenal that are, we call it an arsenal because it feels like one sort of, but in our toolbox, a gentler word, that have LiDAR units attached to them. So these laser scanners so that we can do a combination of scanning from the sky and scanning from the ground and combining those two data sets into a full 3D model for planners and designers. So that's the big thing. And with that, it moves us into this bigger picture of 3D city modeling. So what we're starting to incorporate now is the ability to use intelligent 3D models. So these types of models, they call them BIM models, building information models. If you've ever heard of GIS, sort of applications, geographic information systems. So if you know what GIS is, which is everybody kind of has a something, some version of that in their car that guides them around the city, we can do that for buildings as well. So you can document every part of that building, all the materials of that building, the energy performance of that building into a database that's linked to the 3D model. And we play in that world a lot. And so doing this on a macro scale with cities to sort of see the pulse or the organic sort of lifeblood of a city and how it's operating and its efficiencies, how its utilities are functioning, all of this into a sort of a massive urban planning database is kind of the next evolution of where these micro projects that we have is going into this sort of macro environment. So I believe that's the stage that we're at. We're moving into this larger spectrum of intelligent modeling. They're already doing it in Dubai. They've modeled the whole city. And I think Portland's going to be not too far in the future to be doing the same thing for the city of Portland or the public, you know, Portland Development Commission or other agencies, because they'll be able to access what they need to know about how to circumvent disaster and a variety of other applications in the city.
That's cool. I've seen, I think it was some sort of a, like almost on like a time lapse thing for like a 24-hour period. It was just showing how kind of that wave of energy and, you know, when lights are coming on and how the traffic's moving you know, I guess then just the application to the industries that need to be aware of that, I guess power and your traffic and maybe employment for different, you know, businesses that cater to the commuters, et cetera. But that's cool.
Yeah, sure.
I'm looking down my list of stuff, everything from, you know, crashing to the future there. And I'm excited to talk about this stuff because I just think it's so cool. But I want to ask you as I'm trying to wrap up here: is there anything that I didn't ask you that you think that I should have, or that you wanted to say?
You know, I think that the interesting thing about this technology and the science I think I'd like to put out there for a lot of people is that it's here to stay. And it's becoming accessible to so many people now that we are going to be seeing the data in a new way. We're going to be experiencing our environment in 3D now rather than just photographs and two-dimensional sort of things. Everything is moving into the direction of a fully immersive sort of contextual environment to understand design, to understand planning, to understand other people, spaces, and so that's really kind of where we sit, is in that space of providing these 3D visualizations and information so that people can make better choices. And there's just a myriad of applications for that. So I'm really excited about what this holds, and I think that in the future you're going to see this virtual reality kind of environment become more prolific, and it starts with this type of data and these types of technologies.
That's great. Before we wrap up here, what's the best way for somebody to get in touch with you?
Well, I think the best way is just to visit our website at topa3d.com. Our contact information is on the website, and we have some interactive models that we're posting up now in 3D that people can play with and understand a variety of environments and local areas here in Portland. We're starting to scan some well-known areas, and so you might see some place that you've been or a favorite restaurant in the near future.
That sounds good. Well, Paul, I want to just say thank you again for taking some time today to talk with us. It's been fascinating to learn about what you're doing and the possibilities coming down the pipe. And the only thing I'd ask is that hopefully you're available. We can do this again soon.
My pleasure, Darren. Thank you. I look forward to it.
All right. Sounds good. I hope you enjoyed my interview with Paul Tice of Topa 3D, and you learned a little bit more about how drones are used in commercial real estate. For more information about Topa 3D, I encourage you to go to their website at www.topa3d.com. That's topa3d.com. That about does it for us. But before we go, if you like today's program, please let us know. We'd love to hear from you. Please like, follow, share, and comment. Your input is always greatly appreciated. Until next time, thanks for listening to Commercial Real Estate Pro Network's CREPN Radio.
You're listening to CREPN Radio for influential commercial real estate professionals. For more information on this or any of our guests, like us on Facebook, CREPN Radio.